Now, the Three Martini Lunch with Greg Corumbus and Jim Garrity.
And welcome, everyone, to the Thursday edition of the Three Martini Lunch, along with Jim Garrity of National Review. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. We have good, bad, and crazy martinis for conservatives today, and our good is actually genuine applause for Republican presidential nominee Donald Trump, who surprised a lot of people on Tuesday by announcing that he was going to Mexico on Wednesday to meet with the Mexican president. And there was a little bit of secrecy there since there was no traveling press. But Jim, Donald Trump did, in fact, have a press avail with the Mexican president. He took a couple of questions after that. And I think the major takeaway is that Trump actually comported himself quite well in that moment. He listened respectfully as the Mexican president spoke, and then both his tone and the contents of his remarks, for the most part, also seemed to strike a positive note, and some might even say a presidential note. Here's just a couple of his quotes.
I was straightforward in presenting my views about the impacts of current trade and immigration policies on the United States. As you know, I love the United States very much, and we want to make sure that the people of the United States are very well protected. We are united by our support for democracy, a great love for our people, and the contributions of millions of Mexican Americans to the United States.
So, Jim, the bar to clear for Donald Trump, I think in the minds of many people, wasn't that high to clear. A lot of folks were just hoping he didn't look at him and say, "You're sending all your rapists." So anything better than that was seen as a plus for him. But a lot of folks, even folks who have been very critical of Trump for many reasons, like Charles Krauthammer, thought he did himself a world of good yesterday, leading into a speech with a very different tone in Phoenix last night, where he still said a lot of things I think a lot of conservatives agree with. Probably one of the better days for Trump on the trail.
It is. There's three kind of aspects to this. One is that apparently the Mexican president issued the invitation to both candidates, and it probably is a good idea. It's a fair question about whether presidential candidates should be meeting with foreign leaders, about whether that's kind of treating someone who is not the president on par with the president himself. But the Mexican president decided to offer both of those. It looks like Trump responded quicker and basically said, "We want to do this as soon as possible," and arranged for it to happen yesterday. Apparently, the U.S. Embassy in Mexico thought that wasn't a good idea. Apparently, the Secret Service didn't think it was a good idea. Trump said, "We're doing this anyway," and it worked. They pulled it off. The logistics were fine. No problems with security. The lack of advance warning might have actually done some good in terms of not giving Trump critics in Mexico, and there are many, much of a chance to do anything disruptive or anything like that. What was unusual about Trump's appearance is there was nothing unusual about it, right? You know, he went out there. He was cordial. He was soft-spoken, low energy, I think, as he would have characterized it if Jeb Bush had said the same thing. But he's respectful to the Mexican president. The Mexican president had disagreements but was respectful to him. As I mentioned, when you see a foreign location with all the marble and the flags behind them and the two podiums, it looks like a standard international summit. The Mexican president is on one side and Trump is there. And it just looked like a great deal it looked normal. It looked like another U.S. leader speaking at a president. And so the good portion of the Hillary Clinton argument against Trump is, one, he's crazy and unhinged and he can't control himself and he has zero impulse and he can be baited with a tweet and all that stuff. At least for that day and at that moment, Trump acted professional. You could even say he acted presidential. If the argument of Hillary Clinton is he's going to go overseas and embarrass us, his knuckles scrape the ground as he walks, he drools on himself. He acted perfectly fine. And I think that kind of surprised people and pleasantly surprised people. And the fact that Hillary Clinton has not partaken of this invitation is a little bit surprising. I guess maybe she worries about the idea of maybe playing into Trump's hands and appearing to be too friendly to it. The other thing was kind of fascinating about it was how much the Mexican media thought their president had completely screwed things up by offering this invitation. They feel like Trump played him like a fiddle, and the entire thing ended up working very well for Trump and not for the Mexican president. So kind of fascinating, but as you said, it's a good day for Trump and, a little bit more nimbleness and tact and just good judgment on their part that people may not have expected. This was indisputably a risk, and it looks like, at least so far, it's paying off for him.
Yeah, and just a quick aside on the speech last night. Well, Trump's kind of been all over the place in the last few days about what to do with those in the country illegally, but haven't been a problem with the law in other ways since that time. That still is obviously in flux. If he can stick to deport the criminals, protect the border, and get rid of sanctuary cities, I think that's going to win him some points too.
You know, that's always been a fine position to me, Greg. But you know who else like that? Every other Republican candidate, which we were told was amnesty and open borders, global, you know. So it's a little insufferable to see Trump coming around to that position. Having said that, I guess we shouldn't give him too much grief for coming around to a position that, you know, the vast majority of Republicans think is just fine and probably close to what our immigration policy ought to be.
Well, true. And it does matter what his ultimate opinion is on that. But when the Democrat won't even go with those three things, it should be a pretty easy win on that issue. And we'll see if he can actually articulate that in the debates. But anyway, on to the bad martini now. And this is courtesy of Jim Garrity over at the Morning Jolt with quotes courtesy of Politico. Great news, America. Your tax dollars were used to supplement the salaries for Clinton Foundation staff. Quote, Bill Clinton's staff used a decades-old federal government program originally created to keep former presidents out of the poorhouse to subsidize his family's foundation and an associated business and to support his wife's private email server, a Politico investigation has found. Back to Jim. This is the Clintons in a nutshell. Use a private server to escape Freedom of Information Act requests and congressional subpoenas and make the taxpayers pay for it. Back to Politico. Taxpayer cash was used to buy IT equipment, including servers, housed at the Clinton Foundation and also to supplement the pay and benefits of several aides now at the center of the email and cash for access scandals dogging Hillary Clinton's presidential campaign. This investigation, which is based on records obtained from the General Services Administration through the Freedom of Information Act, does not reveal anything illegal, but it does offer fresh evidence of how the Clintons blurred the line between their nonprofit foundation, Hillary Clinton's State Department, and the business dealings of Bill Clinton and the couple's aides. So, Jim, not exactly anything shocking here that the Clintons would bend or potentially even break the rules to their advantage, but it just shows how slippery and how manipulative they can be.
Besides the fact that, yes, it makes perfect sense that they figure out a way to get taxpayers to pay for the server that they were using to keep their communications away from Freedom of Information Act requests and congressional subpoenas and all the other ways that the taxpayers should be able to see these communications unless they have something with national security in them, which we now know they did. One of the things that jumps out about this is, look, you know, every president gets a certain amount of staffers. Every president gets a fairly generous pension. The fact taxpayers pay for an office, they pay for their correspondence and letters and things like that. And this is all pretty normal. We can argue about whether that's, you know, once you leave the White House, the opportunities for a former president are so lucrative about whether they still need these things. But I guess Harry Truman ran into trouble back in after his presidency. And so they set this up to ensure former presidents would not have to go and do commercials or things like that and look kind of silly and demean the office or kind of, you know, do something undignified. Well, here comes Bill Clinton, and we all think about dignity in the Clintons, and he not only gets, you know, the standard amount. I remember when he set up his offices in Harlem, the taxpayers were on the hook for much higher rents than most other presidents. The amount charged to this was more than almost anyone else has ever done. Now, for some of these categories, it's set a certain amount per president, and you can't go above that. But in the case of this, they were using this basically to top off the salaries of people at the Clinton Foundation. This is not really what this was set up for, and it indicates how much the lines between Bill Clinton's post-presidency, the Clinton Foundation, Hillary Clinton's life as a senator and a secretary of state, all of these things started blurring together. And if you wanted access to one, you just made a donation to the other. And it's a – look, there's a reason this story is not going away. Also, we noticed and was debating about whether this make this one of our martinis. Hillary Clinton's disapproval rating is now 1 point lower than Donald Trump's, meaning they are now roughly equally disliked by the American public. And you got to figure it's stuff like this nagging sense that she and Bill will do anything they can, get away with anything they can. They're utterly shameless. They kind of feel like the government is there to serve them, and that because they're on the right side of history and because they think they're serving us, and yet they keep profiting in exceptional ways and unprecedented ways.
Hillary Clinton, according to the ABC News poll, disapproval at 56% now, only 41% approval. The good news for her is that Donald Trump is even worse, 35% approval, 63% disapproval. But interestingly, Jim here, Hillary Clinton was at the beginning of August favorable among women 54 to 43. Now she's underwater at 52 to 45. So this whole I'm making history thing not standing up too well when we have stories like this day after day after day.
That is fascinating. Greg, do you think that's all the foundation stuff, or is it just a, oh, we're going to deal with the Clintons for another 4 years?
I think it's both. I think it's insulting to women, for her especially during different points of the campaign, that the main reason people should vote for her is just because she's a woman. She finally backed away from that after it didn't seem to be working much against Bernie Sanders either, but then she kind of trotted it out back leading up to the convention. So I don't know if we're going to hear more about it. But yeah, I think the steady drumbeat and knowing that she's just constantly lying to people about virtually everything, from Benghazi to her emails to whether or not these donors had access at the State Department, is grinding down on her. And even though the media has not covered it to the extent that we would probably like, I think the news is still getting through.
You know, maybe the more she says, I am doing this as a representative of all women. I wonder how many women say, no, you don't.
That's right.
You don't represent me. No. Don't. That's the old song by the Police. Don't stand so close to me.
Jim, you mentioned something there about the rule about making sure presidents aren't in the poorhouse. And so presidents don't have to do undignified things like doing commercials. I was just trying to think of some of the different infomercials that different ex-presidents could have done over time. If we went with Bill Clinton, obviously, they would get into PG-13 and perhaps even R-rated material. Ah. But I could just imagine different things like, Richard Nixon selling quality recording devices.
A real-life example. I have heard this story. I don't know where it is, so someone can double-check it. Maybe it's an urban legend, but I'm pretty sure I've heard that when they made Back to the Future 3, one of the jokes in Back to the Future is Doc Brown asks Marty, who's the president in 1985? And he says, Ronald Reagan, the actor,
right.
In utter disbelief. So the idea was they wanted in Back to the Future Part 3, they go back into the time of the Old West.
Right.
And the plan was to have Ronald Reagan playing either the mayor of the town or something like that. But the plan was that, one of the great, to kind of play with that joke, they were going to have it. They made the offer and contacted Reagan's people. And the answer was, it's very flattering, it's very nice, but it would be beneath the office of the president for him to make a cameo appearance in a movie. So it didn't happen. I think a lot of people would have enjoyed it, but I think he's got a point that, you're not, even though he was an actor and this is what he was doing before he entered politics, it wasn't something he wanted to do. And so a part of me just kind of looks like whether, one would have made it a much better movie. One of the great all-time cameos. I mean, you and I have always said that he's there in spirit in Die Hard.
Correct.
Because his offices were in Nakatomi Plaza,
right.
Or at least the building used for that. So there was a good line that I don't think it's outrageous to say, when you're president of the United States, you have your 4 years, you have your 8 years. And then you're supposed to leave. And it's, pass the torch and let somebody else take over. And you're kind of supposed to leave the public stage and not have the same role in public life. And it's very clear the Clintons did not intend that. That everything that happened between Bill and Hillary, which was obviously meant to start in 2009, was merely a brief interruption in the Clinton dynasty. And we may very well be on our way to that second chapter there.
All right. Well, speaking of President Reagan, we've got some bad news on that front. This is courtesy of ABC News. And Jim, we knew this was coming. I think we just have the official date that this starts now. Quote, the man who attempted to assassinate President Ronald Reagan 35 years ago will leave a Washington psychiatric hospital to live full time in Virginia on September 10th. A federal judge ruled in July that 61-year-old John Hinckley Jr. is not a danger to himself or to others and can now leave St. Elizabeth's Hospital to live full time at his mother's home in Williamsburg, Virginia. Hinckley was found not guilty by reason of insanity in the 1981 shooting of Reagan. Reagan's press secretary, James Brady, and two law enforcement officials outside the Washington Hilton. In his July 27th ruling, Judge Paul Friedman wrote that Hinckley was a profoundly troubled 25-year-old young man, that's putting it mildly, when he shot Reagan in an effort to impress actress Jodie Foster, but he has not exhibited symptoms of major depression or psychotic disorder for more than 2 decades. Apparently still has to check in every once in a while, Jim, but Craig Shirley, the Reagan biographer, says that the fact that there was even an insanity ruling in the original trial was largely because of a jury in Washington, D.C. that wasn't a big fan of Reagan. At least that was his assessment. But regardless of that, the fact that John Hinckley is a free man after what he did to not only Reagan, but Jim Brady and the two law enforcement officers is a travesty.
If this does turn into a major point of public debate today, and I think you and I are doing our part – You may hear some people saying, oh, come on, it was 35 years ago. Well, imagine a scenario where Lee Harvey Oswald is not shot by Jack Ruby, but instead is incarcerated. Assume he acted alone. Assume that he's not, you know, that none of the Oliver Stone conspiracy theories. And imagine 1998 rolls around and he qualifies for parole. Like, could you see Lee Harvey Oswald walking around in the late 90s?
I wouldn't want to.
Right? I think Make America would be okay with that. How about having John Wilkes Booth walk around in 1900? I have this crazy belief that if you take a shot at a president, you spend the rest of your life in jail. Real simple. But in the case of Hinckley, never mind his attempt on the president, he shot four people. This is a mass shooting. And the other thing which is really sticking out to me is people say, oh, look, Hinckley didn't kill anybody. The coroner of James Brady tells you otherwise, that ultimately James Brady's death 33 years later was but as a result of the injuries that were sustained when Hinckley shot him. Now, you know, they chose not to reopen the case. I have read about a study where they have had someone dies of a shooting 10 years later. Coroner looks at it, looks at the cause of death, determines it was a result of the shooting. Sometimes it's a bullet lodged in the spine or some sort of complication because of that shooting where the person would not have died otherwise. And they have reopened it as a homicide case. And they chose not to do this, obviously, the insanity plea, in that they probably have an argument about double jeopardy there. But the idea that Hinckley, you know, the judge thinks Hinckley's not a threat now, so what? Right? He ruined four lives, or at least ruined one major life and caused, you know, great pain and suffering to another. Why is this guy walking around? And the last part, which is just the single most insufferable detail I have read in an article this year. And as you know, Greg, this has been a challenging year. Hinckley's lawyer is named Barry Levine. He's been a lawyer for a long time. And he says, people of goodwill should celebrate his achievement and success, meaning dealing with his, you know, I guess his mental illness in the perspective. And then he said, the line that just makes me want to retch, Greg. Quote, I think he will be a citizen about whom we can all be proud. Greg, my response is not appropriate for this family podcast. Stick it where the sun don't shine is the cleanest way I can do it. You know, So a frustrating, crazy martini. You know, someone might say, oh, our martini pled insanity this year. And now it'll be out in 35 years. So
sure, Jodie Foster will be going to Colonial Williamsburg real soon, too.
So there we are, deeply frustrated. It's something that's I've never understood this. And everybody's like, oh, he was insane then, but he's not insane now. Well, he was crazy enough to kill people then, but now he's totally fine. I guess he's on medication. He's perfectly normal. And we have no problem with him walking around the streets, and there's no chance he's ever going to do it again. Really? So anyway, that's our crazy martini for the day.
Yeah, they're sure of it. There are better ways to make sure of that.
Or you could say life in prison as a consequence for shooting four people.
Jim, on that note, talk to you tomorrow.
See you tomorrow, Greg.
Jim Garrity of National Review. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Yeah. Thanks for being with us today, and be sure to tune in again on Friday for the next 3 Martini Lunch.